I'm Alex. James is with me too. We are Stentorian, and thank you for listening to our podcast. You can check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. You can follow us on Twitter at themacguffinmen to keep up with what we're doing. We most recently talked about Jackie. The week before that, we talked about, well, not the week before that, many weeks before that, we talked about Traffic, and then before that, The Lobster and Rush Hour preceding that. I think next week we'll probably be talking about Moonlight, so you can listen for that, but that's not what we're talking about today, so we'll just get to the theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Yes.
Here we are, podcasting yet again.
Yeah, I think the theme song is a little slow.
It was a little too classical. I didn't know Handel had done our remix for us.
Yeah, we're here. We're going to talk about Manchester by the Sea.
We are.
We're going to explain our feelings.
No, we're going to have lots of long, quiet pauses where we are just emoting visually, but absolutely not using words.
Our feelings about this movie will largely be implied for the next hour.
Yeah, exactly. So, a Kenneth Lonergan picture, as it says right up front in the credits.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about his history or the troubled history of Manchester by the Sea's production?
I'll do a quick Manchester by the Sea history and toss in some Lonergan sure. facts in the middle. So Manchester by the Sea is basically, so long story short, John Krasinski and Matt Damon are friends because Matt Damon and John Krasinski's wife, Emily Blunt, worked together on a super good movie that nobody saw called The Adjustment Bureau, and they became friends. And John Krasinski had the idea for what ended up becoming Manchester by the Sea, told it to Matt Damon. Matt Damon brought it to Kenneth Lonergan, depending on who you believe, around the time that Kenneth Lonergan was having a real, real difficult time editing his last picture, Margaret, which went through many years and many lawsuits of editing. And Matt Damon initially wanted to star in and direct the movie, but then enough time had passed before the movie was actually ready to be made that Matt Damon couldn't do either of those things anymore.
He was too busy with his Chinese ponytail movie.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And then, so Kenneth Lonergan basically took up the directing reins, and Casey Affleck got to play the role of Lee, which Matt Damon would have played. And apparently John Krasinski was supposed to have a role at some point in the production as well. I would imagine he would have played the brother, but that something about that doesn't work to me. Damon and Krasinski.
His last name's not Chandler.
No, well, no. And it's just, I think it's a part of the reason that Manchester by the Sea works as well as it does, or the casting of it does, is just because Casey Affleck looks so much younger than he does, and Kyle Chandler looks like a hotter version of somebody his age, you know? Like, like Kyle Chandler looks like an older brother to Casey Affleck, you know? Whereas that just doesn't exist for Matt Damon and John Krasinski. It's possible Krasinski would have played the friend that ends up adopting Patrick, but you know who can really know these things. But well, besides John Krasinski and Matt Damon and everybody involved in the making of this movie, but that's basically it. And the story on Kenneth Lonergan: this is his third movie. Accomplished playwright, screenwriter of a couple notable films. Analyze This. Yeah, it was Analyze This that he wrote, as well as he was a screenwriter on Gangs of New York. His two previous directorial efforts are You Can Count on Me, a very good movie from 2000 or 2001 starring Mark Ruffalo and Laura Linney, and Margaret, a spectacular borderline perfect movie from that eventually got released in 2011. So he's my boy.
Yeah. So I mean, we both enjoy ourselves some Matt Damon, but
this movie's so much better because Matt Damon's not in it.
Yeah, and I mean, no one can know what a talented director Matt Damon might turn out to be ultimately, but I think it's safe to assume that, especially first time out, he's not coming anywhere close to what Kenneth Lonergan was able to achieve here.
I mean, as a director, this is far and away his best work as a director. Like, it's my second favorite of his actual movies, but you know, if you listen to Lonergan talk in interviews, he talks about how he made You Can Count on Me. he talks about how he had never thought ever before thought about framing in movies until he actually had to think of how to frame one of his movies. So you can see a progression from You Can Count on Me to Margaret of the framing getting better and the use of like cinematic form getting better. Like he uses zooms really well in Margaret. And Manchester by the Sea is easily his best looking movie. But even still, it's just he does sort of have this laid back style to direction where, I think he just believes so much in his own words, and I think rightfully so, that he doesn't need to add too much flair to the movie to make it work, you know?
Yeah, and I would think, I mean, just coming up being a playwright, obviously his focus is so much more on the written word. I would think that even if he came up as a director, just the way he writes, it doesn't seem to me that he'd be of this really highly stylized guy about cinematic flair. You know what I mean? he has a way with words. I mean, people love that he's able to write the way people talk. I don't think it would, you know, the way that this movie lacks poetry and big speeches, I think is, I can only guess would be the way he would approach the spectacle elements of filmmaking.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get down to it.
Brass tacks.
Yeah. You said that this is your second favorite of his. You must have liked it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. And I mean, I like it quite a bit. Saying it's my second favorite movie of his is quite high praise, because I think Margaret is easily one of my favorite post-2010 movies. It's in the top five for sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what is it that's so good about Manchester by the Sea for you?
Well, I think the I don't know, because like when I eventually, by the time I did see this movie, I didn't see it until, you know, it was released in December, and I had heard, you know, I'd been so excited about it because of my aforementioned appreciation of his previous work, Lonergan's,
and you like Casey Affleck?
I like Casey Affleck. The buzz from Sundance was very very promising, and then continued through every other festival for the rest of the year. I think the sign of a good movie is, or that this is a good movie, is that its award season buzz started last January and it was able to maintain it. And that's the same can be said of Whiplash a couple years ago. Like, I think that's a sign of something that really does connect with audiences, is that even people talking about it quietly over the course of a year, like, you can't get tired of it. It just ends up being that good. And
and speaking of talking quietly,
yeah, exactly. But yeah, by the time I saw this movie, I just kind of had my preconceived notions of what it would be, and I anticipated like a little bit of flashbacks, because I figured Kyle Chandler died at the very beginning of the movie, and I also didn't think Kyle Chandler was a one scene actor. So I kind of assumed there would be a flashback in some capacity, but I didn't anticipate the structure of the movie being what it was. This structure is also a break from Lonergan's previous movie as well. So the use of flashbacks, I thought, was really effective and really turns what is what could be a very simple story. Like, I mean, on a fundamental level, the story of this movie is not that much different from something like Garden State, right? Guy goes home, regrets something that he did while he was at home, and has to learn how to deal with it. But it's the structure that sort of twists it, and also the fact that Kenneth Lonergan's a way better writer than somebody like Zach Braff. But just that element of structure sort of twists it, and the fact that Lee, when we're introduced to him, and he's kind of like, he's clearly the cool uncle. He's joking around. He's the little brother to Joe, and they're on the boat, and then we get this hard cut to the present day, and we just see this emotionless Lee. And even when he finds out that he finds out his brother has died, there's just no change in him. And you're just like, how does that not affect him at all? And then about 50 minutes later, you find out why. And just the way that the movie slowly doles out information, and when it chooses to give out that information, I think makes the movie so much better than it could have been as a straight story. You know?
Yeah. I mean, we have people.
I mean, this is a boring movie if it's a straight story.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think there's a few things. I mean, the structure is interesting, I think, for a few reasons. You know, we have that, as you said, we have him built up as this person where we quickly get this juxtaposition between this fun, you know, jovial kind of big kid uncle that he is to this emotionless husk of a man by the time he becomes the handyman in Quincy. And so we have, you know, this question in our head that needs answering of what caused this huge change. And yeah, they answer that through the flashbacks, but even just on that same structural level, it's some of the scenes in this movie are so short and some of them are so long. I mean, it's very odd structurally, not just the way that the passage of time is depicted, but just the way that this is set up scene by scene it's really unique. No,
I mean, it certainly feels that way. I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about examples to compare it to, but yes, you are definitely right that the scene lengths vary very wildly, and in a way that absolutely does not hurt the movie. And it just sort of, that's the type of thing that takes a certain amount of confidence to be able to pull off, and they did.
Yeah, it's a very confident movie, I'd say, in pretty much every respect.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think so much of that is, this is a movie, I mean, just to speak about the confidence of it, this is a movie that has such heavy issues with throughout it. I mean, it's unspeakable tragedies throughout. The guy behind me in the theater leaned over to his viewing partner at one point and said, "What a grim little tale this is."
Oh, boy.
Which I think is quite the understatement, but...
How old was that person? Did you look back?
I would have said about 5 to 10 years older than I was.
Okay, all right. That's really funny. That's a funny choice of words. It's like somebody our age saying that they're a tad bit miffed.
I know. But what I mean to say is, I mean, it's simultaneously this total gut punch of a movie just because of the subject matter, but there aren't those big speeches. I mean, some of the most powerful bits of dialogue in this movie are sentences that are, you know, 4 or 5 words long. And I just wanted to know how you kind of negotiate those two things. I mean, the juxtapositions of, you know, really long scenes, really short scenes, this emotionally guarded dialogue, well, in a movie full of emotionally guarded people. And then some of the epic music choices, as, you know, we kind of touched on a little bit earlier, and the tragedy and the comedy that's throughout this, because there are parts of this movie that made me laugh so hard. And it's such a heartachingly sad movie for most of it. Did that juxtaposition ever damage it for you, or do you think that's where it finds most of its strength?
No, and that was another thing, talking about the tone, that was another thing that semi-surprised me, but also is like very much belongs in my wheelhouse. I've tried to sell people on this movie that used to watch 6 Feet Under by saying it reminded me of 6 Feet Under a lot, and it does, just in the way that it jumps through, it's about such heavy things, but also doesn't forget to try and make you laugh every once in a while. And just sort of the idea that even within tragedy, people are going to try and find comedy. The one that sticks out to me is asking Dr. Bethany, "So what is a good disease?" And her saying poison ivy, like that whole thing is great. Yeah. And I mean, they draw attention to it when Gretchen Mol, whose character's name I forget, speaks up about it. But I don't know, that sort of tone, tonal things, I thoroughly appreciate when they exist in a movie like this. And I don't know that it, since the funny parts are funny and the sad parts are sad, like it just works. It's a hard line to walk, but it's walked. And I think the way that Lonergan navigates the idea of the macro versus the micro is really interesting as well. Like just the way that, I don't know, I was listening to an interview with him where he talks about how he's continually interested in like the feeling of smallness in the world, and how, realizing how small you are inside of the universe, and the way that something like forgetting to put the gate on your fireplace kills your 3 children, and just that small little thing. And then also the way that there's a line in the movie where he mentions he got halfway to the store and thought, wasn't sure if he put it on, and he just sort of kept on going. And just having that small amount of doubt, like what if I had turned back at the 10 minute mark, would that have changed things? And I don't know, just the way that he is able to navigate these giant giant horrible things, and also not forgetting to remember the little stuff. Like, there's a lot of scenes in this movie where we get, you know, things that in other movies kind of don't really feel like they matter, and maybe don't feel like they matter in this movie, but sort of give a fuller picture of people living in a world. And one of the best examples of that actually is Kenneth Lonergan's cameo in this movie. He plays the guy that says good parenting, the guy in the big blue Canada Goose jacket.
Great and, cameo.
Oh yeah, great cameo. He's like, he acts in all of his movies, and he's just such an unnatural looking actor, but like in a way that I could appreciate.
Yeah, and the bright blue coat and his just arms kind of out to the side because of how puffy it is, I think adds to that.
Yeah, for sure. And like, I mean this as politely as possible, he's just kind of a funny looking person, you know, like it just, he doesn't look like a person that would be in a movie, which I think isn't something, adds something to a, especially a movie like this. But anyway, so what's happening there is Lee and Patrick have just left the lawyer's office, where Lee finds out that he is to be the guardian of Patrick, and he sits silently and has his 13-minute flashback scene reliving the worst moment of his life. And he's coming out of that, and that's why he's kind of arguing with Patrick and why he's cursing so much at him. And Lonergan has, you know, whoever Lonergan is playing, has no idea of what's going on in his head at that point, right? And so he says, great fucking parenting, and they have a little argument, and then Lonergan continues on about his day. In any other movie, that scene is just sort of played for this person walking by the street, on the street, just says his piece and then keeps on moving. But we get another shot of Lonergan in this movie, and it's complicated because it is of the director, but I don't think this is a vanity shot, but of him walking away in a dolly shot, and Lonergan's the only person in the shot. Like, Affleck and Lee and Patrick aren't in the shot, and that shot is meant to show that this guy also has a day. He also has something to continue on with, and maybe he had something in the morning of his day that sort of reminded him of shitty parenting, and now he's sort of like on edge about this sort of thing, and he's like, oh, this guy's raising a kid, I gotta speak up about it. Yeah. And it's just sort of the way that all of these people have their own lives that exist without the movie. The only person's life we're seeing is Lee's, and even that we are getting this information piecemeal, basically, especially for the first hour. We're finding out more and more about him, and that's true of pretty much every character in this movie. There's good, slow, really patient reveals of things that might not even be really clear on a first viewing, but you sort of think about them and start to realize why somebody might have done these things. Like, again, Gretchen Moll, what's Patrick's mom's name? Do you remember?
No.
Gretchen Moll. She, like, when she has Patrick over, it's the Matthew Broderick scene for lunch, and when she excuses herself to the kitchen, you know, she's an alcoholic and a recovering alcoholic, and maybe she's worried about seeing somebody from her past, even though that somebody is her child. She's worried about seeing this figure from her past and how that could complicate her present, you know? And they never really, there's no follow-up on that scene. There's an email from Matthew Broderick's character, but that's about it. And it's just like she has these things that she has to worry about that we just don't know about, because we can't ever possibly know everything that's happening with every person, you know?
Yeah, and it's they leave it hanging so much when she leaves the dining room there, then we hear the sound of glasses or bottles or something, you know, just this kind of cinematic language saying, you know, it's Chekhov's bottle, you know, there's this idea that as you said, there's this element of her past, and now it's come back up, and maybe it's going to bring all that negativity and alcoholism that she spent so much time and assumed hard work escaping. And yeah, there is no follow-up to that. And even when, you know, that scene ends, even when it seems like it might be addressed again, we get that email from Elise's husband. That's her name, Gretchen.
There you go. Thank
you. We see Patrick reading the email, and, you know, we hear Matthew Broderick's voice, and it's just cut off right away. I mean, he gets a few sentences in, and it seems like this is someone who wants to control Elise's life, and that's that. And I loved that he just shuts the laptop. That's the end of the voice. Mm-hmm. And as you said, there's no follow-up to that. It's something in Patrick's life that he just chose to to shut out, and that's it. I mean, as far as we know, that might be the end of their communication for the rest of their lives. And I just think that cutting him off mid-sentence like that in the email, and then having that never come back into play in a movie that's largely about shutting things out, you know, we see it done successfully, and nothing comes of it ever again. And same with when Lee goes to the docks to try to get a job and says he wants to pick up a few hours. We have a woman saying she doesn't want to see Lee around here, and we don't know what it is about her, if they had a relationship, some kind of history, or if it's just you know, what she knows about him and his, what I'll call, negligence about his home and his children. And that's it. I mean, there's a certain finality to those things that I think is important to have in a movie like this, that I think is really great.
Yeah, absolutely. Agreed.
Good.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about Lee? I mean, just as a character, do you have anything on him that we haven't got to yet?
I don't know. That's such a big question. That's such a macro question. I've been thinking about micro. I mean, I don't know. It's kind of, I'm trying to think of something that somebody hasn't already said about Lee, and I just think it's all pretty much there. Like, because this movie, he's so much of the focus, and since Casey Affleck was so widely praised for his performance in this movie, I think the I don't know, like that element of his character, like the internal element of his character, has been discussed. I don't know. I don't think I have anything to say about Lee, really. He's obviously like somebody that is clearly dealing with his past at all times. I find the way that, of course, I just said I don't really have anything to say about Lee, and now I'm talking about Lee. But anyway, he can't seem to engage with other people, like when that woman spills the drink on him at the bar, and then also that kid's mom who he just will not talk to when Patrick's trying to have sex with her daughter later.
I was dying during that scene.
It's a great scene.
I need 2 hours of that.
But then also, you know, just the way that, and you can even kind of see it in his face, like he kind of wants to engage, especially that first bar scene. He almost, like, you can almost see him trying to engage and just not having the capability to anymore. Like, he doesn't want to invite a new person into his life. And you can kind of see it later as the scene progresses, when he feels like those two guys across the bar are talking about him, goes over and gets in a fight. Right before he does that, he looks at the woman that he feels like he probably should have talked to and just couldn't. And then he's just taking out his own issues on those guys across the bar from him. And I think the way that that is communicated is all very subtle, and that's both directorially and Affleck as an actor. So like that type of thing, I think is really good. And there's lots of little things throughout the movie that add to Lee's character. But it's just, I would just be continually pointing out all of these subtle things that Affleck does and that the movie does. But that is pretty emblematic of how they get things across about Lee in this movie.
Yeah, it might be different than the way that you read it, but I thought that when, you know, she spills her drink on him very intentionally, it seems like just the natural progression of things. It seems like he still kind of feels compelled. You know, these two people who, you know, odds are probably attracted to each other physically. It seems like it should be his natural next step, and that he feels like this could continue into some kind of, you know, closer, you know, perhaps romantic relationship. It seems like he consciously makes the choice. Like he feels it heading that way and knows that that's still an option, and has to dredge up these horrible memories of, you know, letting people get close to him and the negative feelings that opens you up to. Like, I feel like there's a kind of a moment of a decision. It's not as though he's not capable of it anymore, but he doesn't want to do it. You know, he feels that he could, and that it's there, and that might even be the right thing to do, but he consciously makes his decision not to to pursue that. And I like that. I like that more than he's just this husk of who he used to be who couldn't do it if he wanted to. It's mm-hmm. it's to me, having that ability and to constantly have to tell yourself to not get engaged, I think is the more powerful one than not being able to anymore.
Yeah, and that's more or less what I meant. I just apparently explained it poorly, but you definitely said it way better than I did. But yeah, and you're right that that is an interesting scene. And I think the way that the movie establishes Lee in general, we talked about the opening where they're on the boat and he's the cool uncle because it's a flashback. Joe's still alive. Everybody's having fun. And then we cut to his present. And, you know, what his job is basically like he's cleaning up after people. He's fixing their mistakes, throwing out their trash, all these things. And, you know, it all seems like almost like had you described it to me, like he's a person that can't deal with his past and is like feeling very guilty about all the things he did, all the mistakes he made that he is now cleaning up after others. Like that would seem so hacky to me, but something about the way this movie does it makes it work. And I think partially because all of those scenes are before we find out really anything about Lee. I think that's effective. That makes it more effective. And it's just sort of, you know, he's doing all the things he can't do on his own anymore. He can't clean up after his family because he doesn't have a family anymore, you know? And this is the only thing he can do to not think about the guilt is to just do something, you know?
Yeah. And yeah, I know what you mean. It's not him kind of paying his penance in a way because, you know, you pointed out this is like Garden State. I mean, this is a formula that we've seen before, or at least, you know, a kind of story that we've seen before. He's someone who has been hurt or, you know, has experienced pain and doesn't want to let anyone close in order to not feel that pain again. It's just done so well. And one thing that I really love about the selection of his job as the handyman is we get to see him occupy these domestic spaces, but with no engagement to it. You know, we see him in bedrooms and in bathrooms in these intimate domestic spaces, but he's just someone who does 5 minutes at a time in each of these little, you know, warm domestic homes and doesn't fully engage. And even though the way that it's shot, there's not these kind of warm two shots of him side by side with these people discussing it. It's someone always a little deeper in the frame or just these close-ups of these people who don't get to share a frame and kind of share a moment. And, you know, we have the one of he's unclogging the toilet for a woman, and that's one where it seems that there is positive emotions between the two. You know, they get along. We overhear her discussing that she's attracted to him over the phone to somebody. We don't see any real engagement there. And then we get the other form where there's this hostility between the two. And instead of, you know, kind of swallowing his pride and being the person who's lower status because, you know, he's kind of the employee in the situation and de-escalating the situation, he takes that the other way too, and it just gets ratcheted up until there's this unpleasantness that he is later asked to apologize for and doesn't even see why he should. We get these two notions of things going too well for him and things going too poorly for him, and in both ways they end up in this really negative area, or at least this area of a missed opportunity to either have, in one case, you know, a romantic or at least a friendly experience, and in another case to just have a civil experience with, you know, seemingly a customer. And it just shows that he can't really function in either of those situations. But I really love the handyman choice and the way that he gets to go into those spaces and display his inability to function in them like a normal person with pro-social values would.
Yeah, exactly. And when we do find out where he's living in a basement room with a window that has bars on it, you know, another move or another choice that could easily seem hacky, but it somehow works in this movie because what is he doing? He's imprisoning himself in this cell with bars on the window. And just because he now feels like he is the basement of people because of what he did to his family. And that's another little thing that is set up towards the beginning of the movie that ends up saying a lot about Lee, but doesn't seem hacky because of when it is told to us or when it's shown to us, you know?
Right. And since you bring that up, what did you think of him looking out some of those? He looks out some windows later on in the movie, and, you know, often he's looking towards the water, but I remember a few of them just being oddly obstructed by trees and having these big options, these big obstacles in the way. And it doesn't seem he's looking at those. He seems to be looking past them, but, you know, the shot to the water, to the freedom, to the recollections he has of positive memories there, there'd be better windows to shoot that from. What did you make of that shot selection?
I don't know. I guess it's just that he's not clear through everything. You know, he's not through the guilt, and he never will be. Like, he just wants to get back to the calm, happy seas that he was in the beginning of the movie, and he can't quite get there because there's always going to be things in the way. You know?
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Speaking of the distance like that, and kind of having these obstacles and things in your way, you know, we've talked about a lot about the emotional distance, and in that case, the physical distance. And I think one time that comes together really well is when he does return to his house, when it's on fire and there's that group gathered. And I think so many other movies we see that, and he bursts through the crowd and tries to, you know, help his wife right away, or
he goes,
you know,
full Mystic River.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or he helps his children. I loved him standing at the back of the crowd, and just that's the first moment where we see him just disengaging, and we see him taking that back seat in every relationship and every social encounter he's ever going to have. And I really loved him just standing back there and being the first glimpse of the Lee that we meet at the start of this movie, and that inhabits most of the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't have anything to add there, but you're right.
Okay. Well, what do you have to add to?
I don't know. We haven't talked about Patrick, and I think there are a couple key things about Patrick that make him more interesting than I think, again, the type of teenager that I would predict would be in this movie. Because Patrick, you know, Patrick is a person that I think so often in movies, sad movies about that feature a supporting character that is in high school, that supporting character in high school would be the nerdy kid that hates being in high school and can't wait to leave. That'd be the teen movie character. That'd be Hailee Steinfeld in Edge of 17 that just can't wait to be older, you know? But Patrick is different, and I found that really interesting, the way that he has a lot of friends, multiple girlfriends, he plays hockey, he's in a band, and he basically seems to be a jock, you know, and he's generally enjoying his high school experience. And I just thought that was an interesting choice, and just the level of confidence that Patrick has as a kid in this movie is just so, I find, so different from what I would have predicted. You know, I would have assumed he was like a kid that has no friends and reads a lot of books, you know, because that's just, that's what you would assume would be the case in one of these movies, you know?
Yeah, and then this is just one other thing that goes against him.
Yeah, exactly. And it just sort of, it adds another, you know, another level to Lee and Patrick's relationship, and that Patrick's not going to take any shit from Lee, you know? He's gonna fight back a little bit, and all of that stuff's great. And it also makes his breakdown way better when he freaks out about the frozen chicken. It makes that scene more, I don't know, it packs more of a punch, because he hasn't dodged some of the realities of his life. Like, he goes to see his father's corpse, he turns around immediately as soon as he does, but still he's not running away from these things. And then just the way that we see him just sort of kind of ignoring it, despite we don't really see him like trying to make a decision to ignore it, and then this grief comes and hits him when he's going in the freezer. I don't know. I just think that all of that builds to a way more earned moment for that character than I think it could have been. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's important to the nature of his father's disease. I mean, he's had time to kind of deal with it. Obviously you can't, you can never know what that's going to feel like until it happens. But I think that kind of adds to your point. You know, he's this guy who seems to be good at everything. You know, he seems to be good with girls, seems to have his emotions under control, good at sports, good enough at music, and
at least he's not dragging on the drums.
Yeah, that's right. No, but that, I think you're right, that moment has more of a payoff when we have this idea that he thinks he can handle everything, and it's not done in a particularly cocky way, but he just seems to be a very confident young man. And to have something like that be the thing that sets you off, and I didn't think that was going to happen in that scene, and it was interesting to watch Lee handle that as well.
Yeah. him kicking in the door. And obviously, like, that's another good example of laughs inside of a pretty intense scene, like Lee kicking open the door and saying, if you're going to start crying every time you see a frozen chicken, I really think we should go to the hospital because I don't know what to do about that. I thought that, I don't know, that whole scene in general is really good. And the flashbacks that are around it are smart choices as well, because what we see before that is Joe seeing Lee off as Lee is moving to Quincy. And what we see after that scene, after the frozen chicken scene, is Joe coming to visit Lee and Quincy and furnishing his apartment, because it seems like all he has is a table and three Cokes sitting on it at the time, you know? And just that sort of, you know, having these scenes where Joe is like, you can see it in Kyle Chandler's performance. Joe's like legitimately afraid his brother's going to kill himself that night, you know? And just because it's probably the first night that he will be by himself since the fire. And
since attempting to kill himself in a police station.
Yeah, well, exactly. And yeah, so like there's just a legitimate fear there. And then Joe, when he does go visit him, has to sort of, he's like, no, this isn't happening. I'm parenting you. This is, you know, or I'm big brothering you at least. And that we see that sandwiching a scene where Lee starts to do these things with Patrick, even at a semi clumsy level. I think it's just, I don't know, it adds to the movie.
Yeah. And I listened to an interview with Lana Goon talking about that scene in particular, where he Lee wants to be able to help. He obviously doesn't know how to, because he's never one of his children was never this old. He's never had to deal with this experience of someone losing their father like this, seemingly. And because of what he has dealt with, though, you know, this tragedy of losing his children and the violent circumstance, he kicks that door down because he's someone who's used to thinking in dire situations. Even though we see him, you know, very reserved and very calm for most of this movie, he cares about Patrick very deeply and might not be able to know how to navigate these domestic situations, but just the idea that he might be in there causing harm to himself, that's not a situation that you talk out of. Like, you do whatever needs to be done right away and then you talk about it, but if there's a chance of harm being done, you know, you take the destructive route just to minimize the amount of time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. How about the stretcher going to the ambulance? A little too much for you?
Nope, loved it.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. It's great. Why, too much for you?
It just seemed odd to me.
That's why I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because this, again, this movie is so boring if it's not for these little things where they're willing to break from convention and the flashback structure. Otherwise it's just sad white man goes home again, you know? And I don't know, any element of breaking from what I anticipated from this movie is great, and I would have anticipated that the stretcher works properly, you know?
You wouldn't even have thought about it.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know, and I think the thing that makes that work so well is that is Michelle Williams' performance, like in that scene specifically. Like, she just is a broken woman, and she has to still be so broken, like, while this is going on, and she is lying on top of the source of the problem, you know? And she just has to continue her performance, and I think that she is able to sell that scene is the difference maker, despite the fact that she is not what you were looking at in the scene, because you're like, why isn't the stretcher working? This is a movie. This is where things work, you know? And just the idea that, again, in such a big moment, the biggest moment of Lee's life in a tragic sense, the little things don't always go as planned, you know? Don't always go as they're supposed to.
And so then later on, we get to the police station, you know, and he has to describe exactly what happened, and we get that the music in that scene. I want to talk about that with you. Did you think that works well or no?
First time I saw it, I didn't, and I was sort of, and I remain divided. I don't have a hard yes or no on whether it works. I think it's somewhere in the middle. But you know, as I was walking to the movie, thinking about it, because it's just so. Literally every person I've talked to about this movie has mentioned the music in that scene, which I think is the exact opposite of what I want music to do in emotional scenes in a movie. It's a very John Williams moment, you know? It doesn't totally work for me, but it works better than it did for me the first time I saw it, in that what we're seeing and the way that the music builds is it's at its loudest as, you know, unsurprisingly, as Lee grabs the gun and tries to kill himself. And so what we're witnessing there is basically the climax of Lee's life, even though it happens before the timeline of the movie, or the timeline we're really attached to the most, even begins. It's the saddest moment of his life. It's when he's driven as far as he can and can be into his depression. Like, he's literally trying to end his life to not have to deal with this anymore, his guilt. And it's just the way that the music plays, it's just very climactic music. And the reason it feels weird in that scene is because that happens at like the 58 minute mark of the movie. And we're just not conditioned to feel like music should be that big at the 58 minute mark of a 2 hour and 17 minute movie. And it just feels wrong. And then you sort of, after the movie's over, you're like, that was the climax of his life, you know? And the rest of this movie is reconsidering these things that have happened to him. And what we're meant to be thinking about that music is that music is representing what's going on in his head. And what's going on in his head is a slow build to him realizing how guilty he feels, that to the point where he wants to kill himself, you know? He wants it to be over. He wants this music to finish. And he tries, and it just doesn't work. But that doesn't mean that's not still the climax of his life. Now he's just into the analysis portion of his own life, where he will just continue comparing elements of his present to the one thing that already shaped who he is now, you know?
Yeah, and it's the lack of punishment that he receives that, like, I just don't think that if he was sent to jail, he would try to kill himself that night.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's the lack of punishment and him having all these emotions and nowhere to place it, that I think it is what drives him to attempt suicide there. I think it's knowing that in a way he got away with it, so he's so much guiltier than if he was just in jail for the rest of his life, because while he didn't mean to do it, it was his negligence that caused them to die. And for it to sink in with him that he is going to go unpunished about it, I think is what drives that suicide attempt.
Yeah, the fact that he is at fault for the death of his three children, but not not by the letter of the law, not guilty, you know?
Yeah, not liable in any way.
Yeah.
Except to himself.
Yeah,
yeah, so, I mean, that's the climax where he realizes, you know, that he got away with it, and this is how he feels about what he's done and what he's responsible for. And I mean, the rest of this movie is, as you said, kind of him, that idea playing out, him comparing his feelings now to his feelings then and his feelings before. Is there any uptick at the end, or is this all just that was kind of rock bottom, and now he occupies that rock bottom space?
Well, there is, very briefly. Leading to what I think is my favorite part of the movie, just because I think pretty quickly and pretty subtly the movie accomplishes everything it's trying to show in about like 5 minutes. And so what we get is it's the, I think, probably the only montage in the movie, the only like real honest to God montage, and even by montage standards it's very short. But I'll set it up a little bit in that what we see towards the beginning, when Lee is driving back after he gets the call about Joe, after he hears that Joe's in the hospital, he's driving back to Manchester. And we get this quick flashback. It goes from him sitting in the driver's seat to a flashback of him. He's wearing a yellow t-shirt sitting on the edge of the boat. And it's a shot to a happier time. He's, I feel like he's probably smiling. I can't remember 100% sure if I'm right. But he, you know, the idea is that he is smiling. He's wearing a bright colored shirt. It's a sunny day. He's just sitting on a boat enjoying life. He's where, you know, he's in the future, he'll be looking out to the sea to try and get back to this yellow shirt scene, you know, of him just being happy. And so flash forward to many, many scenes later in the movie, we get it's after Patrick has gone to see his mom. And something we didn't talk about with that scene is that Patrick is kind of realizing that he can't go back to a life with his mom the way that he wants to. It's another moment of growing up for Patrick, and that, you know, nobody can ever really go back. And Patrick has to learn that. And he learns that by seeing his mother, the modern version of his mother. But anyway, so we've got him and his girlfriend on the boat. And Lee is sitting on the same place in the boat where he is in that flashback, wearing green coat, but you know, he's just watching over Patrick. And Patrick lets, I forget the girl's name, drive the boat a little bit. Things seem to go off a little bit, and Lee is ready to get up into action, right? And Patrick corrects it, and he just sits back down, and it's just like, it's this calm moment of him thinking that maybe he had to snap into action, maybe something was about to go wrong, and then it just didn't. So he's just able to be, to casually live his life. And we see him walk around the town, run a few errands, nothing's going wrong, and then he like literally turns a corner and runs into Randy, his ex-wife. And and then what proceeds is, I think, probably like the majority of people's favorite scene in the movie, because it's two amazing performances going on. It's some very real shit being talked about, and she basically she apologizes for some of the things she said to him, and he just desperately wants to be out of that scene. And there's even in the framing of the wide shot, there's a line in between them that he only crosses when he ends up walking past her to walk away. And it's just it's the idea that no matter how comfortable he gets in Manchester, there's always something like behind, like around the corner waiting for him to just crush him, you know? And that leads to the end of the movie when he's telling Patrick about how he can't move back here. He just can't do it. He can't beat it, I think is his phrasing.
Yeah.
And I just think that's such a short period of time. And it's obviously something that's set up very early on, but it's once we get to that actual montage and that scene with Randy, it's so short and accomplishes so much, you know?
Yeah, and we kind of get that back and forth where he, you know, he faces Randy, and again, what I meant earlier by saying that some of these biggest moments are, you know, kind of finalized with these very brief statements instead of, you know, a long speech that, you know, it's very flowery and very meaningful just in its own right. He kind of, it just ends it with Randy by saying there's nothing there. And then things, you know, he's back home, and you wonder if maybe that's something he had to get past, and now we can move on with Patrick. You know, maybe he's kind of successfully put this thing behind him, you know, as much as you could with an experience like that. And now he can, you know, kind of be a father figure to Patrick. And then he burns the sauce, and he knows that he could never, kind of be that figure for anybody else again, just because the guilt and the pressure for him was just going to be too much to handle. And, you know, another short line, he just says, I couldn't beat it. And there's no really extrapolating what that means. It's all just right there. You know, that's what I mean. There's kind of this idea that he got past something, and that maybe getting past it means he'll be able to move on to the next thing. But, he gets past his things with Randy in a way that kind of says to me, I can't go back on, you know, I can't go back to that time in my life, but it's not that I'm past that and now I can move on to something else. It's that I can't go back to there because it's too painful, and I can't replace it with anything because that's also too painful, or the thought of that is too much for me.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's the last time we see Randy outside of the, I guess we see her at the towards the end when Joe's body is lowered into the ground. But you know, and every time we see her in the present in this movie, or Lee even talks to her on the phone, Lee just shuts down, you know. And when he finds out that she's pregnant, when she calls to ask if she can go to Joe's funeral, he finds out she's pregnant, and he just immediately has to get off the phone. Like, he can't deal with the idea of thinking of Randy with a child, because she had three children, and you know, they're dead because of him. And when he sees Randy's new partner at the funeral, he just sort of stares at him, and like, not in a way of you know, a lot of movies there would just be some sort of animosity, but Lee's animosity is all like directed towards himself when he's looking at this guy. I think his name's Josh. And then he hugs Randy, and the camera holds on Lee as Randy walks away, and he just like starts slowly slumping over, and it's just like he's emotionally shut down, you know. And he looks like Denzel after Denzel lost the Oscar to Casey Affleck, basically.
You know? Yeah, no, that scene especially, he looks at that guy. Yeah, you kind of expect the jealousy or the anger there, but it's more inquisitive. You know, he kind of just looks at every part of his face and his jacket and his shoes and his hair, just like, what kind of person could this new person be for Randy? Not how dare she or how dare he, but it's more legitimate curiosity about what her life is like now, or what kind of person it takes for her to move on.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Okay, so you know, taking into consideration what we just said, Lee's choice to maybe spend a little bit of money to get a place with a pull-out couch and the game of bounce the ball that they play together on the road, is that no cause for any positive feelings or any optimism for his
future? That is the positive feeling, is that, like, and even then he kind of struggles telling Patrick, like, so you could come visit, you know, like, even has trouble getting that out, but he at least has the space for it, you know, and he can get that sentence out, and that, you're right, that is positive progression. And that is the sliver of optimism hidden at the end of this movie. Like, Lee is just, he's permanently sad because that is just an unbelievable thing to happen to your family, and for it to happen probably because it was your fault. And just that is enough, you know, and to a person like that, to be optimistic that, you know, maybe he can at least let somebody in again, you know?
But you don't take that as, maybe one day I could be the father figure, but the success, and at least I'll be your uncle. Like, you can,
yeah,
at least,
no, exactly.
I'll never take over as your guardian, but I'm not going to shut you out the way that I shut pretty much everybody else out of my life.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and when we're in the lawyer's office, right before we get the flashback, when he finds out that Joe did make him his guardian, like, that's the most energy we see out of Lee, up to that point in the movie, and in the present, is just like, no, I can't be his guardian. Yeah. I mean, the line he puts a button on the scene with is, I'm just a backup, you know? And he's just so like, no, this can't happen. But by the end, he's at least willing to sort of go back into his backup role, you know, as the uncle. Yeah.
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 So. Well, that's some good optimism to leave.
yeah, exactly. Exactly. Maybe one day he'll be able to go to Manchester and not just be crushed by sadness, but I doubt that is the case.
Yeah. Clamoring for the franchise to we'll get some answers to that.
Yeah, we need the Manchester by the Sea extended universe. Maybe John Krasinski and Matt Damon finally can't have parts in this world.
Ooh. anything more about Manchester by the Sea?
Jim and Pam could move to Manchester by the Sea, and then it could be this whole thing. I don't. What about you?
They build a great wall around the town.
Matt Damon could have his ponytail. It's the best of many worlds. Dragons start attacking. This no longer sounds like a Kenneth Lonergan picture.
No, that's all I've got about this laugh riot.
Okay. Hey, man, it's funnier than a lot of movies we've talked about that are,
it's
less
true.
Sad, you know?
It's true.
Yeah. So thank you for listening to MacGuffin Man, and be sure to check back next week.